This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we catch up with a best-selling author who has become a frequent visitor to Port Townsend. And we learn how you can overcome the fear of public speaking from a local comedian and the former mayor of Squim. And now, we go inside the Compass. Author Pam Houston's most recent novel, entitled Contents May Have Shifted, was honored as one of the 10 best books of the year in 2013 and became the literary selection of the Port Townsend Public Library for its community read. That meant everybody in the community was encouraged to read and discuss the book in advance of Pam Houston's Port Townsend appearance that spring. Although she lives on a ranch at an elevation of 9,000 feet in Colorado, Pam has become a regular visitor to Port Townsend and a popular instructor at the Centrum Writers Conference. Her novel, Contents May Have Shifted, is structured around a series of urgent messages from the pilots of airplanes on the verge of disaster. But it also has Pam's usual bold dose of musings on relationships, mystics, travel, and more. As Pam says, we all have baggage, so we might as well travel with it. KPTZ talked with Pam Houston about the book, where she finds her muse, the difference between writing novels and short stories, and more. We started with the rumor that Pam's so-called fiction is actually true and autobiographical.
How much of it is and isn't true, and does that make you embarrassed or self-conscious as you're writing, knowing this is going out to the whole world?
It doesn't. You know, my bigger fear is you know, hurting other people, and that's the struggle. I'm kind of a confessor, and I'm the sort of person who sits on an airplane and tells the person next to me exactly what's going on in my life, if they want to know. I mean, if they have their book up, then of course I don't. But I have said over the years that my work is 86% true. That's about right, you know. And for me, it's really, that's what the process of writing is. The process of writing for me is paying really strict attention out in the world. I've been lucky enough to travel a lot. I've been lucky enough to have lots of big, wild experiences, you know, both emotional and physical and spiritual. And so my work is paying really strict attention to the precise and specific details of those experiences and coming home and writing them down. But I'm also really interested in shaping a story, which is why I don't just call it memoir. You know, once I have all that raw material, I want to be able to shape it into story, and that sometimes involves altering it, or sometimes the altering of it is to protect people who don't want to be revealed. And so for me, that's the struggle, is having these things that I really want to write about, and I don't mind revealing myself at all and my weaknesses and my failures as well as my joys and successes. I'm not at all shy or squeamish about that, but I also know I'm writing about, say, the man I live with, you know, and he may not want to be portrayed in certain ways. And so that for me is the real challenge, is how much to alter it to protect those people, and then also how much to alter it just in terms of making the very best story I can tell, which again is why I write fiction and not memoir, because I want that ability to, you know, remove the boring parts and say that thing I wish I had said if I had been smart enough to think of it at the time.
You've written long fiction as well as short fiction. How has that done, and what's the difference in terms of the process or the difficulty level for you?
Well, you know, I really believed for a long time that I was a short story writer. I have a particular method of writing that involves kind of collecting little pieces of the world and bringing them together. And the reason that I, for my first two books, wrote short fiction is that I thought, well, I can only juggle so many of those balls in the air. And that turns into a 15 or 30, I would say, at most, page story. That's the number of, you know, discrete objects I can keep in my mind at one time and juggle. That's the way I see writing. But then when I was working on Sighthound, which was my first novel, I really believed it was a collection of short stories. I believed that I was going to write 12 interrelated stories, each told by a different narrator. And then I ran into a time problem. And for instance, I wanted the veterinarian character to narrate the dog's death late in the book, but I also wanted him to speak early about the dog. And so I thought to myself, well, it'll be a collection of 24 stories and each narrator will speak twice. And by the time I thought, okay, it'll be a collection of 36 stories, I was like, oh, wait, this is a novel. This is what they mean when they say novel. And I literally backed into it. I was 150 pages into it before I realized if it was a novel, I could let anybody speak anytime they wanted. And it was really the same process. It was just a matter of making sort of subsets that I could handle. So I divided the novel into five sections. You know, so for me, it's always about smaller pieces adding up to bigger pieces and how many of those I can manage at one time. And my recent book, likewise, contents may have shifted. It's 144 little tiny stories that together make a novel. And, you know, the organization of those pieces was what created the larger narrative arc.
Commercially speaking, how have your novels done in comparison to the short stories?
Well, nothing approaches the success of that first book of short stories in terms of numbers. Both novels have done pretty well. They've been my next two best sellers. And of course, contents may have shifted isn't even in paperback yet, so we don't know how that will do yet. But Sighthound, of the not counting the new book, Sighthound is the second bestseller. So they're doing just fine. You know, I've been really lucky because after that first success, you know, it's scary to think, oh, nothing will ever be like that again. And, you know, as I said, what I really want from my writing career is the opportunity to write the next book. And all my books have done well enough for me to do that. And these two novels, which have been the last two, are doing a little better than the ones in the interim. Yeah.
Well, that leads me to the question about your muse or your inspiration. What is it that sparks the idea that this is going to become a story or perhaps an entire novel? Is it something that happens in your life?
I talk about in my craft talk, I'm going to be talking about glimmers, and I use the word glimmer. I'm not entirely happy with the word glimmer because it's kind of a soft word, but things out in the world, they can be tiny, you know, the way the clouds were hanging over the bay last night or the sound. Or it can be, I was lucky enough to attend a sky burial in Tibet, for instance, which is a big thing. You know, you get to see three bodies just torn to shreds by 200 vultures. You know, tiny things, big things, something overheard in the checkout line, you know, particular quality of the color of the leaves in the fall, just anything. But these moments that say, hey, writer, over here, pay attention, over here, you know, and that's what I call a glimmer. And literally all my work is about, you know, trying to be attentive and noticing those and then grabbing them and writing them down, you know, and then seeing how they might sit next to others of them and make something new by virtue of being put together. And so really the my first job is to notice, is to, you know, Henry James said, a writer should strive to be a person on whom nothing is lost. And that's who I try to be.
Could you talk just a little bit about the process? When do you write, as in what time of day, and how long can you write at a stretch, and what tells you to stop and to start?
Yeah, embarrassingly, I'm sort of a binge writer. I don't write every day. I don't write every week. I don't write every month. When I do write, I tend to write sort of to the exclusion of all other things, you know, 27 hours in a row, you know, realize I haven't eaten or showered, you know, that I tend to be that sort of writer. And partly that's because I do a lot of other things I love. I teach and I do public speaking and I travel every chance I get on someone else's dime or on my own. So a lot of my writing is about fitting it in. I spend a lot of time on airplanes. I'm a million-mile flyer on United now. I'm very proud of that. So I have a rule about doing brain dumps of these glimmers. On every United flight, the pilot will say, we're about 45 minutes out on every flight. I think it's an AA. Basically, what he means is go to the bathroom now because we're about to land. But there's always about a 40-minute window in there. And if I'm not already writing, I like to write on planes. So a lot of times I'm already writing. But if I'm not already writing, from that moment until wheels down, I get out my little booklet and my little pen, and I try to dump all the glimmers that I've been carrying around. And because I find myself on airplanes, I mean, if I was another kind of person, I would do this while my kids were at soccer practice, or I would do it on the train, on the commuter train. But because I find myself on long distance airplanes a lot, it's kind of the most regular thing I do. And it's a way to keep myself from losing some of those glimmers because I'm trying to carry too many of them. And then when I really have time to write, like 2 weeks off or a summer or the month of December, which I often have as a writing month, you know, then I just have all those glimmers downloaded essentially, and I can start to play with them. And that's how the stories emerge.
At one point during our interview, we asked Pam Houston to list some of her favorite writers.
Toni Morrison, Alice Munro, and J.M. Coetzee of the massively famous writers. And then certain writers that really impacted me when I was a young writer, Ron Carlson, Russell Banks, Tim O'Brien, Laurie Moore.
But she left out the late Carlos Castaneda, who sold more than 28 million copies of books like The Teachings of Don Juan, A Separate Reality, and A Yaqui Way of Knowledge.
I noticed you didn't mention Carlos Castaneda, but I read something about him and you.
Yes, that is true. Carlos Castaneda was not a literary influence, but I did meet him in an airport in LAX when I was a young writer, and he told me some things to do with my life. He told me that I should live in the sight of open water, which is something I think of when I'm here. And he told me to live in a house with hardwood floors, which I do. But he also told me to try to live my life in love instead of fear. And I think about that every day. I mean, it's very basic and simple advice, but the fact that he told it to me, a total stranger in LAX airport, has given me the occasion to think about it and to try to do that.
David Cunningham, KPTZ News. Comedian Jerry Seinfeld said most people fear public speaking more than death itself. In fact, surveys estimate that about 3/4 of all Americans admit to great fear or anxiety about public speaking. But help is just down the street. The local Toastmasters Club, formerly based at the Jefferson County Public Library in Port Hadlock, has moved to Seaport Landing, the senior living community on Hancock Street in Port Townsend. Toastmasters International was created more than a century ago to help members improve their speaking and leadership skills, and the group now has over 345,000 members worldwide. The local club is just 4 years old and recently invited two special guests, improv actor and comedian Mike Schmidt and former SQUIM mayor Bill Thomas. In an interview with KPTZ News, Thomas and Schmidt talked about the art of public speaking, their own fears, and how they overcame them. Bill Thomas served as mayor of SQUIM from 1996 to 2002 and now leads seminars on business, so it surprised us when he said this.
I still, to this day, have fear of speaking in public. I get butterflies in my stomach every time I have to go on stage and start talking.
Mike Schmidt has been doing improv comedy and public speaking for 20 years, but he is not immune to the fears either.
I hear that somewhere around 75% of people admit to anxiety or fear of public speaking. Is that your experience?
Absolutely. I find that most people would rather be in the box than giving the eulogy. And what I find is by being able to do some very self-calming and going out there and really truly believing in what I say, I look just like a duck. Calm and cool and collective on the surface, but kicking like heck underneath.
Now that's interesting that you admit to a fear of public speaking. I guess everyone in this room has. So you do improv. Now, public speaking, when you have a prepared speech, I find really easy because I'm reading it and because I have some acting background. But when you do improv, there's that thing that every actor fears getting, which is, I'm blank, I got nothing. Improv, how do you do that if you have a fear of public speaking?
By really getting into the moment. And that's what I always talk about. Be in the moment right here, right now. Forget about everything. And the biggest thing that I find is when people are willing to knock the critics off their shoulder, their mom, their dad, their boss, whatever, and just let loose and bring that childhood back, they'll be able to make up whatever they want. They'll be able to be silly. They'll be able to do the different voice characters that they can do. And they'll really, truly, what I believe, live. And that is in the moment.
We now pick up the interview with Schmidt and Thomas as they take turns addressing the challenges and thrills of public speaking, beginning with Mayor Thomas.
Fear of failure is, I can't speak for other people, but that for me would be a hiccup in public speaking is, oh, I'm going to stutter, oh, I'm going to forget what I was supposed to say, or I'm going to look bad and I embarrass easily. Did you ever have to deal with that?
All the time. Even today, I can practice a speech for 60, 70 hours and get up in front of a crowd and blow it. But the secret is the only person that knows that I blew it is me. So if I forget my lines or forget a sentence or a paragraph or a whole section of the speech, I can go on, and 80% of the time, nobody will ever notice.
What are some of the tricks or keys to effective public speaking, and perhaps a trick or key to overcoming that fear?
Really, truly believing in what you say. And I find that if somebody is wishy-washy, or they're talking about something that they don't know or they don't love, they're not going to hit it. And you can get the trifecta by three very simple keys. Talk about what you know, talk about what you love, and to talk to people that are willing to listen. And if they're willing to do that, it doesn't matter what you say. You can stumble through it. You can say the uhs and the ums, and you can mumble and fumble through it, but they'll be so intently, because they want to hear your message and you're speaking passionately, you'll be a success.
And what's that feeling like when you have a fear of public speaking, you have an anxiety about it, and then that day comes when you do it and you hit a home run? Can you explain how that feels? What's that like?
After the home run, you want to hear about the home run? The home run is great because you were elated, you got through it, you made it, you didn't fall on your face, and all of that. Plus the fact that it just feels good when people come up afterwards and ask you questions about what you were talking about and point out something, or even just say something, wow, that was great. That is like gold.
Do you think this is a skill that everyone should try to cultivate in their life?
Yes.
And if so, why?
I do think it's a skill because every one of us has stories. You see, one of the things different that I do than most public speakers, I tell stories. Almost everything I do has a story behind it. And I use my own personal stories and other stories I've heard to get a point across. And that's the way you get the audience attention, is with these stories, because to just get up and give off dry dogma doesn't really work. But I can get you excited in a story. I'll start telling a story, and I can get the room totally silent and just listening for that punchline. And it takes time to learn how to do that. It took me a long time to really develop that, but it does get the point across. And when you pull it off and you get away with it, it's really great. I'll tell you one. A friend of mine's a professional speaker, and he had to follow the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders at a luncheon for an insurance company.
Talk about a tough job.
And the MC was drunk. And he got up and said, well, our next speaker's is Billy Bob. He's going to get up here and tell you something. I don't know what. And he went and sat down. And so he got up and about two sentences had the audience deadly silent.
Wow.
Just amazing.
That's a home
run. Yeah, that's a home run right there. But you can do that. You can just sit there. You can get an audience, an unruly audience, and just start talking, and all of a sudden, everybody stops. And it doesn't take much. One of my favorite openings, and I've told Bill this, is to get an audience and just stand up and say, my wife believes in ghosts. You talk about a quieter. I mean, an audience stops right there.
You got their attention.
You got their attention.
Yeah. What drew me here was humor. I believe humor is vitally important to message delivery. But not everybody is funny. So what advice, and you are funny, I've heard you. So what advice for a public speaker, especially a novice public speaker, would you have when they know or you can see they don't have the gift or the timing for humor?
Some people, unfortunately, are never going to be able to pull off a joke. And as a public speaker telling the joke and having that joke come out in the front, everybody knows exactly what you're doing. But if you tell a story like Bill was just saying, and not truly looking for the funny, but let the funny come out, it will come out. My improv group, I tell them, stop trying to be funny. Because when you try to be funny, it's forced. Let the funny happen, because people are identifying with, oh, I have a dog that did that same thing in the same place, and my wife found it crawling into bed. And it's not even really anything specific, but it's just letting the funny come out. being able to tell the story about the guy that won the lottery and he went home and he told his wife he won the lottery and they've got millions of dollars, pack your bags. And she goes, where are we going? He said, we, you're out of here. And that's just the funny story that actually happens. It happens, but finding those little stories, reading the little story and finding out where is that irony? Where is the pun? Yep. Where is the not, the purple cow, so to speak? Where is that alternate way of looking at it? And I love James and the Giant Peach, the movie, because the guy at the beginning said, try looking at it in a different way. And when you're writing a speech and you're looking for humor and you can't find it, look at it in a different way. And it's so much fun because even in my comedy act, I pick on my wife a lot. And if you left halfway through, you would think I'd be misogynistic, which the punchline is, I'm a man and I really don't know what I'm talking about. And she is absolutely the strong rock. And most people go up and say, and you live with that? You must be laughing all the time. But there is a way to be on the stage, and then there is a way to be at home and to be relaxed and meditate. And the unfortunate thing with people is they think that the comedy mic is always there, or the Bill Toastmaster, the public speaker is always there, where we also have time that we need to step back and reflect on upon ourselves and really just take a chill pill, so to speak, and a nice tall glass of coffee and just relax. And so a lot of people go, oh, you're that funny guy, tell me a funny joke. That's not really what I do. Is I tell those funny stories and look at it in a different way and find out where's the irony in this. And then you find the irony and you can find the humor. And join Toastmasters. I mean, that would be perfect because one of the manuals shows you exactly how to write a humorous speech. Hmm. It teaches the 10 fundamentals. Gives you a good basis, and then as an advanced speaker, you can learn how to do a toast for a wedding, an after-dinner speech, a presentation, a sales presentation, and that's your college degree. And anybody that's willing to learn to communicate needs to do that.
With humor, misdirection is the key, really, and Mike kind of alluded to that. But it leads somebody down a path, and then all of a sudden you take a right turn, and they're expecting you to go straight. That's what the best humor is. You don't have to tell a joke. You don't have to, and especially about other people. It's really bad to get up and talk about, like if I was going to tell a joke and use you as the butt of the joke, you're going to sit back and think, oh my God, you know. But using yourself, I all my humor is directed directly at me. It's always about something I did or I didn't do or I should have done or about my interaction with my wife. But almost all of it is with misdirection. I'll go on about something and then take a left or a right turn when they're not expecting it.
Very few people can read a speech and make it engaging because the pacing of normal speech is what we're used to. And so those pauses, like I just put one in, helps you pay attention. Would you recommend speeches mostly from bullet points or from a word-for-word script or off the top of their head?
Well, my method is I write a speech and then I edit it about 30 times. And then I practice it about 70 or 80 hours. Then I put it away and forget about it. And then I ad lib it. Uh-huh. I don't read a speech. I don't keep notes. I get it fixed in my mind what I want to say. And if I happen to leave something out, that's the way it is. If I happen to switch sentences around, I do not memorize everything I'm going to say. The only things that I memorize are my opening and my ending. And most importantly is the ending. Because that is the critical part of the speech. Because the last thing said is what people are going to remember. And I even, when I'm giving a speech and I open for questions, I open up and say, before I conclude, are there any questions? Once the questions are over, then I give the conclusion of my speech. Uh-huh. Because there's always some drunk in the audience that's going to get up and give his thoughts on what you just said, and that's what everybody's going to remember.
Interesting point. I hadn't thought. I've never worked a room with drunks before, perhaps you have.
A lot of these things come at like 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the afternoon after a long chicken, lunch and several bottles of wine and drinks and stuff like that. So,
and I think if you truly do your job as a speaker properly, you should have people in the audience that are inspired to be, man, I got to tell you my story. And they will try to take over your presentation. Yeah. You let them shine, and then you pull it back, and then you do your conclusion. And I'm like Bill, I do the same thing. I start with my closing 13 magic words. I close with Bill taught me that, and I use it all the time. I write my speech at the beginning with what I want to end with saying, the close. And then I write it like Bill, write it down, and then I start editing words. And so my opening may just be, my wife and I took a trip. Or if I want to go, me and my wife took a trip in the pickup truck. You know, you throw that different grammar, and then they go, okay, now he's okay, and they understand that. But my wife and I went on a trip. We went to Hawaii, we went to the Bermuda Triangle, we went to Florida. And the best thing about the trip is we were able to save money by going through Sousa Park Travel in Port Angeles, Washington. You know, and that's how I end it, because Bill's paying me to speak. And that's how I do it, is I bullet point, and then I try to do just like Bill. And after a while, you will cut the words that are on the paper to bullet points, almost like like Bill taught. In a PowerPoint, very few words, because you don't want them reading it, and you definitely don't want to be reading your speech. And if you know the important thing, the dates maybe, the locations, the time, those are some important things in a very large font. And then after that, you should be good to go.
You gave a little explanation, I believe, of what Toastmasters is at the beginning.
Yes.
Can you do that for us again?
Okay, well, Toastmasters is basically about communication skills. That includes everything from body language, facial expressions, eye contact, being able to stand up in front of a crowd, and listening. The most important part of Toastmasters is the ability to listen with power. And a lot of people don't understand powerful listening, but it is crucial to any relationship you have with people.
When did you come to Toastmasters? I'm wondering if being mayor led you there, or being experienced with public speaking led you to become mayor.
Unfortunately, public speaking led me to be mayor.
Okay.
Actually, I started in 1984 in Toastmasters, and I started Toastmasters because I got up in front of county commissioners to tell them something, and all I could do was get my name out and my address and said I was for it and sat down. Mm-hmm. After doing a lot of research on what I wanted to say. And so I knew I had to do something.
Bill Thomas left government 12 years ago, so we asked him what he's doing now.
I'm working with my daughter at a travel agency and speaking. I do seminars on business. I teach how to develop outstanding employees.
Ah, very good. And Mike, what do you do for a living?
I work as an outside consultant for a major Fortune 500 company, helping people do the remodeling projects around their home, mostly exterior projects.
So are you in construction or architecture advice? What do you do?
I'm a consultant, and what I do is price everything out, and then we have an install team that comes in and basically implements everything that we talked about.
It says right here that you're a comedian and an improv actor. Is that a ruse, or what's up with that?
When I do improv and comedy, it's turning very quickly into a full-time, but you've got to feed the baby.
Sure.
And my baby is doing improv and acting and doing voiceovers, and you've got to pay your bills first, and my kids are out of the nest now, and now it's time for mom and dad to go play around the world.
And what have you done in the way of improv and acting, and for how long?
I've been doing improv with Inertia Improv for about 20 years, 5 years before that with a group over in Spokane, and I absolutely loved it. I was able to really develop different characters, different voices, be able to do clean comedy in a world that is, quite frankly, very blue and very raunchy, and still be able to get the laughs.
And are you with Toastmasters?
Absolutely. I'm a member of Port Angeles Club number 25.
The world's first unofficial Toastmasters meeting was held in 1905 at a YMCA building in Bloomington, Illinois. Ralph Smedley, director of education for the Bloomington YMCA at the time, saw a need for the men in the community to learn how to speak, conduct meetings, plan programs, and work on committees, and he wanted to help them. Today, Toastmasters is open to men and women of all ages, and they even have special programs for youth under the age of 18. Worldwide membership has grown to nearly 20,000 clubs throughout 142 countries. Within the sound of my voice, you can find Toastmasters clubs in Port Angeles, Squim, on Whidbey Island in Oak Harbor and Freeland, and of course here in Port Townsend. The one-hour meetings are free and open to the public, and you can find the Port Townsend Toastmasters Club at the Seaport Landing Senior Living Facility, 1201 Hancock Street. They meet at 6:30 p.m. on the second and fourth Wednesday of every month. With former Squim Mayor Bill Thomas and comedian and actor Mike Schmidt, this is David Cunningham for KPTZ News.
Mm-hmm. This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by David Cunningham. The Compass airs Mondays and Saturdays at noon, Tuesdays at 5 p.m., and Wednesdays at 10 a.m., exclusively here on KPTZ, the home of eclectic, authentic community radio. For the news team here at KPTZ, 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm David Cunningham.